My name is Torin Finney, and this is a class on the conscientious objector, then and now. I work in Narnia during the week. I'm not on the normal teaching staff, but published a book recently, which is a biography of a World War I conscientious objector, a Roman Catholic. And Jerry Swanson asked me to do a class on this. Welcome. Come on in. The presentation basically has four sections, and I'd like to ask you to hold questions until the end of each section. Each section will be about 10 minutes or so, and then we can have a time for discussion. I'd like to begin by reading you a few things. One is a letter written by this fellow during World War I. His name was Ben Salmon. This was the letter he wrote to President Woodrow Wilson after he registered for the draft. It's dated June 5th, 1917. His Excellency Woodrow Wilson, President of the United States, Washington, D.C. My dear Mr. Wilson, complying with your edict, I registered today. Your mandate was autocratic and contrary to the Constitution. Nevertheless, acquiescence caused injustice against no one but myself. Consequently, I submitted. But I must now tell you that I refuse to submit to conscription. Regardless of nationality, all men are my brothers. God is our Father who art in heaven. The commandment, thou shalt not kill, is unconditional and inexorable. If the parent orders the child to do wrong, the child should disobey. If the state commands the subject to violate God's law, the subject should ignore the state. Man is anterior to the state, and God is supreme. Both by precept and example, the lowly Nazarene taught us the doctrine of non-resistance, and so convinced was he of the soundness of that doctrine that he sealed his belief with death on the cross. The great mass of people still adhere to Christ's teachings against war, regardless of the fact that cardinals, priests, and ministers have repudiated the Christian ideal and bowed to the God of expediency. There are many ways to avoid war. Now that you are in it, there are many ways to get out of it without sacrificing or threatening to sacrifice a single life. Solution of the problem, without breaking the commandments of God, is merely a question of desire and determination. Aside from right or wrong, why concern ourselves about German injustice while unmindful of the disorder of our own house? In America, millions of impoverished citizens vainly send forth their mute appeal for justice. Their supplications are answered with greater tyranny, renewed iniquities, and a further disregard of their rights and their liberties. Show me any German cruelty that can outdo in horror the massacre of the women and children in the tent colony at Ludlow, Colorado. And the underlying cause of the Ludlow tragedy manifests itself daily throughout the length and breadth of this land of liberty, although it is only when given spontaneous expression that we even notice the misery and sorrow and seething despair that is slowly eating out the heart of our boasted civilization in America. Why not correct the wrongs at home? And then there's a quote from St. Luke chapter 6, verse 42. Hypocrite, cast first the beam out of thine own eye, and then shalt thou see clearly to take out the mote from thy brother's eye. I am not an alien sympathizer. I was born in Denver of Canadian-American parents, and I love America. This letter is not written in a contumelious spirit. But when human law conflicts with divine law, my duty is clear. Conscience, my infallible guide, impels me to tell you that prison, death, or both are infinitely preferable to joining any branch of the army and contributing either directly or indirectly to the death of my fellow working men. I voted for you and worked for your election in 1916, and I still have faith in you, hopeful that you may see the right and have the courage to follow it. I am sincerely yours, Ben J. Salmon. Then something a little more recent, which was written 70 years after that letter. This is from the New York Times, and it's dated August 29th, 1987, so just about a year and a half ago. And it's written by Charles A. Maresca, Jr., who is the Associate Director for Counseling for the National Interreligious Service Board for Conscientious Objectors in Washington. So for the record, here is what conscientious objectors object to. We object to killing. We object to killing in the name of capitalism. We object to killing in the name of communism. And we object to killing in the name of religion. We object to being forced to register for war and killing, and we object to being forced to participate in the preparations for war and killing. We object to killing innocent civilians, and we object to killing soldiers. We object to nuclear weapons, and we object to conventional weapons. When war comes, many of us will perform peaceful alternative service. Many of us will go to jail rather than compromise deeply held beliefs. But we will not fight. We will not kill. The term conscientious objector has two words. The first, conscience. That's the inner voice within us. And those who make a stand against war for reasons of conscience are claiming to that the inner voice within them is saying that this is wrong to participate in war. And objection, obviously, is that's a refusal to engage in something. So there's a refusal for reasons of conscience to engage in war. The first section of the presentation, I'd like to focus on a historical background, and since we only have an hour, this will be pretty superficial, but it might give us some food for thought on the development of conscientious objection in this country. I'd like later on, if there's anyone who knows anything about the situation in other countries, it'd be nice to get some input on that later on in the session. In the 18th and 19th centuries, those who objected against war were almost exclusively from the Quaker and Mennonite traditions. The Christians of other denominations, for the most part, didn't see that as an option in their tradition. And of course, the Quaker and the Mennonite traditions came out of a belief that life is created by God and therefore should only be taken by God. During the Revolutionary War, a number of Quaker leaders, because of that stand, were sent to a labor camp in Virginia and considered, they were accused of being traitorous and pro-British, and they were confined in a labor camp in Virginia for the duration of the war. During the Civil War, there was what was called a substitute clause, which means if you didn't want to fight, you could pay someone else to do it for you. And I forget what the cost was. I think it was $25 in 1861 currency, which was a lot of money. And once again, there were Quakers. If any of you have seen the movie Friendly Persuasion, that deals with that issue. A Quaker family who was confronted with the Civil War, and the Rebs are coming up to invade their area, and the son and the father and the mother, too, have to decide what they're going to do, and it's a struggle for them. Towards the end of the 19th century, the Spanish-American War saw the Jehovah's Witnesses come into the scene. And the Jehovah's Witnesses objected for an interesting reason. They feel that they're willing to fight in war, so their position's not a pacifist one, per se, but they're only willing to fight in Armageddon, which is the final battle. So unless it's Armageddon, they won't fight. And so they didn't, and they got sent to jail during that period. And it wasn't until World War I that conscientious objection was recognized by the government in any formal way, which is kind of mind-boggling to me. You know, it took about 150 years before the government recognized it at all. And in 1917, there was a law called the Conscription Act that became law, and that allowed for a number of exemptions from the draft, one of which was those whose religious tradition forbids participation in war, which means that these people, the Quakers and the Mennonites, were finally given an opportunity to legally do something other than carry a gun. And so many of them went into non-combatant capacities in the army, like medic and secretary and cook and clerk and those sort of jobs. There was also what was called the Friends Reconstruction Unit in France during World War I, which was kind of a relief corps, and the Quakers went in there. They were still required to be in the military, so they were still military personnel, but they weren't required to carry a gun. This fella that I wrote about, as a Roman Catholic, he was in trouble. The Catholic Church was the most supportive of the war effort. And if I can find you a sort of a juicy quote here, it gives you an idea of what he was up against. His worst enemies during this period were his fellow Catholics, which was kind of sad. Mm-hmm. Ben Salmon, this was a World War I conscientious objector that I wrote about. Cardinal Gibbons, who was the leader of the American Catholic Church at the time, said, "The primary duty of a citizen is loyalty to country, exhibited by an absolute and unreserved obedience to his country's call. The members of both houses of Congress are the instruments of God in guiding us in our civic duties." And then another cardinal from New York City said, "Criticism of the government irritates me. I consider it little short of treason. Every citizen of this nation, no matter what his private opinion or his political leanings, should support the president and his advisors to the limit of his ability." So this fella, by saying he was against war and military for religious reasons was going against the grain of his religious tradition at the time. And he was imprisoned for 2.5 years, 6 months of which was spent in solitary confinement on bread and water. They transferred him to 8 different federal institutions because of the influence he was having on other prisoners and guards. And while he was at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas, he organized a strike of 700 prisoners because he had been working in the prison commissary and found out that the prisoners who were growing food on the farm, the food was being sold for profit, and the prisoners were left with what one of the prisoners called a steady flow of slimy garbage or something like that. And he found out what the cost was that they were selling off for profit, and he told all the prisoners and they stopped working. And the commandant was enraged and came in with a guard, and they had fixed bayonets, the prisoners just sat there and wouldn't do anything, and finally they forced him to their cell blocks at the bayonet point. And when they found out that he was the instigator, they put him in the hole, they called it, which was right over the prison sewer system. And it was a cell about this wide and about this long. And so his suffering was pretty severe that he went through. Later on, he went on a hunger strike because he felt that even eating their food was helping them continue his imprisonment. And they kept him alive by forced feeding, which did severe damage to his whole digestive system. And he died at an early age after his release in 1932. He died at 43 years old. So, and that was a typical story of World War I. The hysteria around the whole war effort, I mean, if you said anything against the government, you know, you were just the enemy. You were worse than the Germans, you know. And especially German American citizens, you didn't have to say anything at all and you still get persecuted. So that's World War I, not a very happy story. In World War II, the Alternative Service Act was passed into law in 1942. That allowed conscientious objectors of the peace churches, the Quakers, the Mennonites, to participate in civilian service. So they didn't have to take military oath and wear a uniform like the Quakers did in World War I. But they, you know, they could work in a hospital or a lumber camp or something like that, an approved civilian assignment. And once again, if you didn't come from a peace church, you had a very hard time getting the alternative service. And of course, like it, as in World War I, World War II, the patriotism and the sort of the anti-German and anti-Japanese hysteria was so strong that if you were a conscientious objector, you were pretty much ostracized from your community. Korea, Sunday is the 44th anniversary of Hiroshima. After the atomic bomb came into being, a number of people who had been willing to serve in the army before that decided that, well, if there's nuclear weapons involved, I'm not going to fight. And that's called nuclear pacifism. We'll talk a little bit about that later. Conscientious objection was likewise very small. All the way up through here. It wasn't until Vietnam that we saw large numbers. There were 171,000 men who were legally given conscientious objector status from 1963 to 1973. And that doesn't include the ones that left the country or evaded the draft or went underground. That 171,000 is just the ones who the government knew about. So the numbers are mind-boggling. And to give you a difference, in the Catholics at least, World War I, there were 4 Catholics that went to jail for refusing to fight. Vietnam, there are around 12,000. And that's about 7% of the total. The 1980s, the registration for the draft was discontinued in 1974. And then President Ford granted amnesty to those who had fled the country, President Carter and President Ford. And by 1976, all those who had left had been granted amnesty and were allowed to return. Then in 1980, after the Russians invaded Afghanistan, the registration of the draft was reinstated. President Carter wanted to be tough, you know, and show them who's who. I was part of that original group in July of 1980 who had to register. I was 18 years old and went to the post office with my father, who's a captain in the Navy Reserve, and got the card, and I said, I don't want to do this. He says, well, if you don't, they'll slap you in jail, and at that age, I didn't really want that to happen. So I filled the card out, but then he said, why don't you put CO? So that's what I did. And ever since then, the registration is continuing. So any male within 30 days of his 18th birthday has to register for the draft, or you can face up to $10,000 fine and 5 years in prison. Now, the government hasn't really been very strict. During the Reagan years, President Reagan didn't focus a whole lot of his attention on enforcing that, and there was a number of people that I was in college with who just didn't register, and nothing happened to them. The ones who were prosecuted usually were the guys who made a public stand, you know, a big sign, I'm not going to register, you know, kind of attracting the attention. We haven't had a draft in the 1980s. We've had the registration, but we haven't had a draft because we've had just as much involvement in the wars around the world, but we've had what's called low-intensity conflict, which is kind of a euphemism. What it means is that the same amount of American arms and money is going around the world to finance wars. We're spending just as much, if not more, money in El Salvador as we did in Vietnam. But the numbers of American troops are lower. We're not sending American troops, except as advisors. So, in Grenada is another example of that. Now that the army is more of a volunteer army, you know, when we want to be involved in some sort of a conflict, the volunteer army will go in. The special forces, usually a small force, like we saw in Lebanon, when the Marines were killed. And Grenada and also Central America is an example of that. The Philippines, I found out, is very similar to the Central American situation now as far as our role there and you know, the finances that we're sending. 1990s, there is a proposal in Congress now. It was created by Senator Sam Nunn of Georgia. He's the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee. His proposal is that we have a national service program, which would mean anybody who wants financial aid on the federal or state level has to do 2 years in military service or an approved civilian service assignment. Now, there's a lot of support for this. You know, a lot of people say, well, the youth of today are, you know, irresponsible, and we need to get them back into the, you know, kind of a respect for their country and responsibility. And there's some merit to that argument. The problem with the law at this point is that the civilian service assignments are much more underpaid than the military service assignments, and they're not advertised as much. Basically, there's a difference in the recruiting budget. The military has all sorts of money to recruit, you know, and they make it look really good. And the civilian service is sort of treated as an afterthought, even though the intention is, even though some of the language paints the picture that both of them are equal. In the law, the way it's written now, it's sort of a one-sided thing. So that's kind of a brief overview of the historical situation. One other thing I wanted to say is that until the Vietnam War, Christians were not permitted to be conscientious objectors by their churches, except for the peace churches, the Quakers and the Mennonites. In 1963, Pope John XXIII issued a letter called Pacem in Terris, which condemned the arms race and called for nations to refuse to participate in war if nuclear weapons are involved. So he advocated this nuclear pacifism. And he also asked governments to respect conscientious objectors, including Catholics. So that was the Pope. It wasn't until 1968 that the U.S. Catholic bishops took that step and said that it is legitimate for a Catholic to be a conscientious objector for reasons of religious belief. And after the Catholics did that, a number of the Protestant groups, including the Lutherans, joined in. And by 1972, towards the end of the war, most of the mainline denominations allowed for conscientious objection. Yeah, we'll talk about
that. Did it in World War I.
Did they?
Yeah. World War II, Korea. It's a formal position.
Okay, well, that's good. I didn't know that.
There are more Methodists actually number count in World War II than any other denomination.
Oh, that's great.
But there are more Methodists than there were Quakers. So
yeah.
Percentage-wise,
okay.
It wasn't significant, but
right.
Number-wise.
Was that there were a number of Methodist denominations. Was one sort of more tending that way than the others, or were they all sort of, was it the free mass of the Methodist Church, or was it the...
The Methodist Church in 1939. Yeah. It was
right.
The largest group. Yeah.
That's interesting. So by the end of the Vietnam War, conscientious objection was allowed. On the government level, in 1965, a couple of Supreme Court cases addressed this issue. There were two young men who were conscientious objectors for ethical reasons, not religious reasons. And one young guy, I think his name was Seeger,
he argued that he should be allowed to be exempt because of his ethical beliefs. You know, he thinks it's wrong to kill, not because he believes in God, but because he just thinks it's wrong. And his case was won. And so ever since 1965, you don't have to have religious reasons to get that exemption. Any questions about this before I move on to section two? Jeff?
Back in World War I, when Wilson was elected, there was one of the reasons people voted for him because they thought he was going to keep the country out of the war.
That's right.
How could he...
That's what he voted for.
And a lot of times, how could he can change, you know, all those people who were against World War I to being so pro-war within a matter of months? How was he able to do that?
Well, you have to kind of come to your own decision about that. This guy decided that Wilson was sort of a puppet of the profiteers. He saw the war as a war fought by the poor to save the rich's dollars. And if you look at the guys that got drafted, they were the mechanics and the longshoremen and the farmers, and they weren't the, you know, the middle class.
Was it just large propaganda?
Well,
the government that changed everybody's mind?
There was a lot of that, as there has been in every war. And also, there were some very strong American economic interests which were at stake if the Germans won in Europe. And so, you know, it's similar to the situation in South America. You know, you kind of wonder why we've supported the right-wing dictators so much. And if you look at our companies, which have the coffee crops and the fruit and all that, it's, you know, if we kind of let the revolutions happen, we lose a lot economically. And this guy's argument was that war is usually fought for economic reasons, and the poor are the ones that get it. So, Rebecca?
It also seems like Ben Salmon was used a lot by the government propagandizing against him. I mean, he was used as an instrument to get people in support of the war and afraid of saying anything against it.
Yeah, he's sort of a scapegoat. She's read part of the book. they have the Denver newspapers were just amazing. They said he was they described him as violent, and he lashed out at his draft board when they wouldn't approve his claim, and he loves the German flag more than the Stars and Stripes, and he's got a yellow streak up his back and broad as a country highway, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this guy, fortunately, was one who didn't mind negative attention, so the more they did those sort of things, the more stubborn he got. And pretty soon, that's why the other prisoners, you know, rallied around him. So they were inspired by his example. He didn't seem to be affected, at least on the outside, and he did suffer within. Other questions? Yeah.
Am I right that, do I understand that young men have to register at their 18th birthday?
Mm-hmm. Right. Since 1980, they have to register within 30 days. That's right. Doug?
In Colorado, I'm not sure if it's in other states or not, they made it impossible for anyone not registered for the draft to receive any financial aid.
Right.
Which a lot mm-hmm. of us came to the discussion of, great, if you can't afford, if you rely on the financial aid to go to school, you have to register. If you're richer, you don't have to register because you don't need the financial aid.
Yeah, little vouchers that you had to sign.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's those are from what's called the Solomon Amendments. There's three laws that were passed. They were started by this congressman named Solomon. And the first one was more narrow, and by the third one, they pretty much encompassed everyone who was applying for financial aid that they had to register. That was one of the... I said that they hadn't been very strict about enforcing it. That's one of the exceptions. They figured, well, they can get more people to register that way. It's worked a lot of ways. Uh-huh, back.
And who does it hit the hardest again?
Sorry?
And who does it hurt the most again?
Lower income. That's right.
Mm-hmm. This is just in response to what Jeff was asking. Also, just because a lot of the propaganda was, this is the war to end all wars.
Right, World War I, that's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and a lot of people believed that. I think by World War II, they became the solution because suddenly...
yeah. Hitler was worse than the Kaiser, you know, and what happened, you know, people were shocked. One more, and then we can move on for this.
Yeah, I just was going to say about the same thing. Many, many people I know voted for Kennedy because we weren't going to get the Korean War, or Vietnam War, we were already in it. And then the same thing we were talking about the other night, of the newspapers. It's just a lot of lies, all half the things. could read my newspaper.
By the time Kennedy was elected, we were as committed in Vietnam as we are in Central America now. We pretty much were supporting the president there, President Diem. And you're right, yeah, it was. And you don't really know that because it was secret operations are doing it all.
Mm-hmm. Just two more comments. Also, the low-intensity conflict, there are just as many people dying in the wars all over, but it's not affecting us, so we're not as easy to get against it. Mm-hmm. And also the National Service, what's interesting, and last time during the deception is a woman from Germany, they have National Service there, and she said that the same thing happened there, where if you don't do the military service, you also get really low paid and are looked down upon in the community if you do take civil service.
Mm-hmm. Although she also said something interesting. In addition to that, she said that the economy in Germany really depends on the conscientious objectors because they're running the hospitals and, you know, all the social service. I thought that was interesting. Let's move on to section two. We can come back to some of this if you like.
There's some current information. Did you want that now or later?
Sorry?
There's some current information about some of these places. Do you want that now or later?
Other countries?
Yeah.
Let's hold on that till the end. We'll talk about that. Now I want to say a little bit about the Christian tradition and, you know, what is a Christian? How's a Christian supposed to respond to this? There's been a number of... how am I supposed to respond to that? There's been a number of different responses in the history of the church. I'm going to list them up. There's basically seven. The first is called the militarist. And this person is somebody who believes that military might is divinely ordained by God to fulfill God's purposes. That's somebody who believes that that the Armageddon will happen, the nuclear war. You hear some Christians talking that way. So let's not worry about, you know, stopping the arms race because it's all divinely ordained. The Crusades went on this principle, you know, we got to destroy the heathen to regain the Holy Land. Biblically, this group looks to the book of Joshua and also some of the other holy war traditions in the Old Testament, in which you see that God, you know, according to the text, God orders the people to wipe out the non-believers, every woman, child, and man. And that's disturbing for a pacifist. You know, what do you do with those passages? They're there. The second group is conscientious participant. This is somebody who doesn't believe necessarily that military might, see that, is ordained by God, but they do believe that government is ordained by God, and if the government calls you to the army, you go, because that they're ordained by God, and the government is. Conscientious participant. And there are a number of, the military has a lot of people like this who are believing Christians who are in the military because they feel, you know, it's their duty and they're fulfilling their civic responsibility that way. They're not, these people aren't here, you know, they don't think war is good, but they feel that, you know, you need to have a defense and they're willing to obey orders, pretty much any orders too. Although, in more recent, well, I'll get to that later. A conscientious participant is pretty much someone who will obey pretty much any order from their officers. But you see the difference between these two? There is kind of a nuance there. Then there is the nuclear pacifist, which I mentioned earlier. The nuclear pacifist is a conscientious participant also, but if there's any nuclear weapons involved, they won't obey orders. And recently, some of the statements put out by the national church bodies, most notably the Methodists and the Catholics, call for any military person who is ordered to use nuclear weapons to disobey. You know, if you say, if you're a Catholic, for example, and you're ordered to use nuclear weapons, you work in a submarine, for example, disobey. And this person will do that. They won't obey that order. This person might. You know, so there's kind of a difference there too. And then we have the different groups of conscientious objectors. One is called selective conscientious objector. This is somebody who will only fight in what's called a just war. A just war is a tradition that goes back in the Christian church many centuries. It goes back as far as St. Augustine in the 4th century AD. This is not a biblical position per se, but it was developed in response to the question, well, what can the Christian do to prevent innocent suffering at the hands of an unjust aggressor? Are we supposed to just stand here and let the barbarians destroy all the Roman towns and kill all the families? Are we supposed to just stand there and let that happen? Or should we do something about it? And the selective CO will fight in a war that involves a number of conditions. One is that it's only a defensive war. It's not an aggressive war. Only soldiers are to be attacked. In other words, prisoners, civilians, clergy, anybody who's not carrying a gun and on their 2 feet shouldn't be attacked. There's also the condition of proportionality, meaning that the damage done by engaging in the war should not outweigh the cause and effect, right? That proportionality. Then there's right intention. You can only enter a war if all the negotiations have failed and at the last resort. You can only enter a war if it's to preserve rights that have been violated. Legitimate authority. Only a duly ordained government can declare war. So in other words, there's a number of conditions, and this person will fight if all those conditions are met. Now, what we'll see in a while is that with the advent of nuclear weapons, it's hard to... These people find themselves kind of agreeing on a lot of this, because with nuclear weapons, you can just throw out the just war right there, because they cause so much damage that there's no way you can change the conditions. And as we'll see later, some of the pacifist groups argue that a war can never be just. You're always going to get civilians getting killed. You're always going to get aggressive wars, too. Every war has an aggressive element. There's no such thing as a purely defensive war, according to some. Then the next group is conscientious objector. I'm going to use the military lingo here. 1AO. This is somebody who's not willing to carry a weapon, but is willing to be in the military in a non-combatant capacity. They're willing to go through the military oath and the physical boot camp and all that stuff, as long as they don't have to carry a gun. Then there's conscientious objector 1O. 1A, by the way, is the government designation for someone who is on active duty. They're ready for active duty, they've passed the physical, and they're ready to go. And then O is objector. So this is somebody who's willing to do it. Conscientious objector 1O is someone who is willing to perform alternative service, but is not willing to go into the army in any way. So that's the difference between these two. And then, let's see, that's 6. The last one is what is called non-cooperator. And a non-cooperator is not even willing to perform alternative service because they feel it's cooperating with the military. And these two, on the both ends, they see the military and military service in totally opposite ways. This person sees military might as divinely ordained. This person sees it as satanic and will not fight in any, not cooperate in any way. This fellow, Ben Salmon, started out here, pretty much, and moved here after he experienced the persecution that was happening in the prisons against the conscientious objectors. One fellow refused to wear a uniform and work in the yard, so he was hung by his wrists for 24 hours without any food and water. Another fellow, two guys from the Cutterite Brethren, I believe, refused to wear a uniform, and they were put in cold water and their feet in cold water and made to sit for several hours. They caught pneumonia and died and were buried in the uniform. And Salmon saw this kind of stuff and he said, this is evil, I'm not cooperating in any way. Fortunately, that kind of stuff doesn't happen as much, if at all, in war. At least we don't think so. Although our government is still involved in the training on the covert operations level, they're still involved in training other governments and those sort of practices, like we see in Latin America. So, these 7 positions have been seen throughout history, and they're still seen today. these two up here, you find support for these two in some of the more conservative, especially this one up in some of the more fundamentalist churches. If you listen to some of the TV evangelists, you might hear this kind of stuff once in a while. Then the mainline churches, the Roman Catholic, the mainline Protestants, Methodist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Episcopalian, they support everything from here down to here. So it's a pretty wide support now, you know, in 1989. The favorite position of the Lutherans and the Catholics is this one right here. Luther himself believed that war is sort of a necessary evil. And if the conditions of the just war can be met, then you can fight, but if not, you shouldn't. Then the Mennonite and Quaker and Anabaptist churches support these three. So, yeah, I think the United Methodist Church is somewhere up here, actually.
No, right here. He's the one more.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was
officially in our document.
Yeah, okay. So, are there any questions about those, about this material? Once again, like I say, there's biblical support for all of them, really. These people tend to look at the Sermon on the Mount and Romans 12, resist not evil with evil, and all that sort of thing. This person tends to look at Joshua, Revelation, those sort of books. This guy looks at Romans 13, you know, government is duly ordained by God and you're supposed to be subject to the ruling authorities. Interestingly enough, this person and this person both look at that passage, look for support to that passage, render to Caesar, therefore, the things that are Caesar's, and God, the things that are God's. This person believes that his body, if you will, belongs to Caesar because he's a citizen of that country, so he's willing to be subject to Caesar. And this person believes that his life is of God, so he can't give that. It's interesting. Ben Salmon used that passage to support his argument, and he got just as much flack from people who disagreed with him, saying, well, I don't know what that passage means. We're supposed to fight. Another thing is when this woman came up to him once and asked him, why wasn't he willing to fight for his country? And his answer was, my country is the world. So that he had sort of a global consciousness in that way. So, are there questions about these positions, these traditions in Christian history?
Is that pretty clear?
It's kind of confusing because you really have every perspective here, which is, you know, sanctioned by Christianity. So someone from the outside will look at the Christians and say, well, God, we don't agree on anything on this. So, and it is a hard issue, and each one of us has to kind of struggle and decide where we are, you know, here. It's important to do. I know my uncle flew a helicopter in Vietnam, and he said when he was drafted, he had never thought about the Army and what it meant. His card came and he went. And after he did his stint in Cambodia, he came back and he said, you know, if I would have thought about this, I wouldn't have done it. And I think a lot of, you know, young guys, 18, 19 years old, you're not thinking about that. Oftentimes you just get out of high school, you don't have a job, especially if you come from a low-income background. You're not a college graduate. The military looks good, you know, they offer benefits and so on. So it's important. Some of the draft counseling I've done, I don't advocate any one of these positions with the people that I talk with, but I ask them, I present this stuff to them, and I say, what do you think? You know, what do you believe about this issue? And it's important to respect that, what you believe. So, then finally, I wanted to talk about some related issues. Conscientious objection fits into some larger ethical issues that relate to the sanctity of life and, you know, what is our attitude to the government supposed to be? And I'll just list some of these up on the board. One is what Cardinal Bernardine of Chicago has called the seamless garment. We coined this phrase based on the crucifixion story where Jesus' robe didn't have a seam on it, so the soldiers couldn't rip it, so they cast lots for the garment. And Cardinal Bernardine argues that the different life issues are all one piece, and we have to take them together. And he says, he lists war, abortion, euthanasia, and capital punishment. His argument is that these are all the same issue. You have to look at these as one piece. And you can't be... Well, he challenges those who are against some of these and not against the others. And he says, well, how can you be against war and for abortion? That's sort of a contradiction. Or the opposite. How can you be, you know, so against abortion and for capital punishment and war? And in the Catholic Church, this position has gained some support. It's still a minority voice, I would say. There's still a number of people who distinguish between these two. And they are different issues. I think the challenge of Cardinal Bernardine is that the taking of human life happens on many different levels, and you have to kind of think about that. I mean, how do these relate? Can you be for one against the other? Maybe you can. His challenge is just that we look at that. Okay, then another issue is civil disobedience. This has become almost a political science, really, in our own time. This wasn't really a large, massive movement until the time of Gandhi in the beginning of the century. And it's the whole idea that you can affect social change by nonviolent protest on a massive level, or even on a small level, actually. And there are a number of people who have pacifist beliefs who believe that in peacetime, you have to continue the struggle against war by doing this kind of stuff. So you have people chaining themselves to Air Force base fences and breaking into bases and hammering missile components and sitting down and getting arrested. You have the Berrigan brothers in the Vietnam War Philip, he was sort of a crazy one. First, they took some blood and poured it on A1 file, or 1A files, and then him and his brother Dan got hold of a special forces manual, made some napalm, and broke into a Catonsville, Maryland draft office and burned on how many hundreds of files. And said the Lord's Prayer and got arrested. So that's kind of this is an issue of contention. There are many people who might have pacifist beliefs who don't think that this is really effective. So some people are more interested in this than others. I know that there are some pacifists who think that doing those kind of actions is violent, so they don't want to participate in that. They don't even destroy property. They want to be totally nonviolent. And others make a distinction between property and people. So that's another related issue. A third one is war tax resistance. This is one that affects everybody, all of us. Unless you somehow don't have to pay taxes, you might make little enough money that you don't have to pay. Most of us have to pay taxes. And there are a number of people who might not be of draft age, or who might not be, or are women, who feel, well, the draft is not an issue for them, but they're still paying for a war through their taxes, because currently 40% of every 40, out of every dollar you pay, about 40 cents goes to the military. And there are a number of people who, this is a hard issue, because the IRS is probably one of the most powerful of the government agencies, and if you are delinquent on your taxes in any way, they're after you like that. You know, it's really a well-funded group. And some of the responses to this, some people will withhold that 40%, you know, that goes to the military, and they're willing to, you know, have the IRS take some of their assets away. Others will kind of pool their money together and file taxes as a community, so it's harder for the IRS to get at the money. Then there's a number of people who still pay taxes but are supportive of some sort of a provision for those who are against war. And there's a group called the Campaign for a Peace Tax Fund. tax fund is a bill that is sort of competing with the national service bill now. And this would provide for anyone who can substantiate that they have conscientious objections to war, regardless of who you are, old, young, male, female. It'll provide that that portion, that 40% that goes to the military, can be channeled off to constructive purposes, such as the United Nations, the Peace Corps, peace education programs, that sort of thing. And that has some support, too. I don't think it has as much support as national service, but there is an organization in Washington, D.C. that is lobbying for that. This is sort of the position that people feel more comfortable with who don't want to get in trouble with the law, but who still have these beliefs. Then, another issue, which I've only recently begun to be interested in, is nonviolent parenting. I didn't see the connection here, I don't know why, until pretty recently. But if you think about this, soldiers and violence is sort of nurtured from a young age. There are certain ways of parenting that will reinforce an aggressive, defensive, problem-solving approach to life. And there's other kinds of parenting that encourage a more reconciliation-oriented, relationship-oriented way of solving problems. This is a hard issue. I mean, it's hard to be a parent. For those of you who are parents, you know that. The challenge of this is, you know, every time you hit your child, for example, you're giving them a message that, well, this is how you solve the problems, like that. And then the child will grow up and that's what they believe. And then there's other ways of disciplining which might not encourage that kind of message. So this is an issue that relates to all of this because, you know, really it starts in the home. His mother thought, she was from Ireland, and she thought military life was loafing. That was her attitude about it. So she discouraged all of her children from going into the military. So he got that from an early age from his parents. And yes, Jerry?
Reminded of something that President Bush called for in his inaugural address, that how important it was that mothers teach their children patriotic songs. You know, that prepared them to sacrifice for the nation.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's where it starts in the home, you know, because if you start early, you get the message.
Yeah. Write letters to TV stations when I see, you know, I'm appalled with the violence in the cartoons.
Right.
It's supposed to be entertaining. So we can take some action on things like that and not sit quietly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Even if we're totally committed to nonviolent parenting, like you say, the media is just bombarding us constantly with violent
images. And the toy stores that just tell them they're not going to buy anything. Yeah. The stores that have all the war toys.
Right, let's get the newest model of the Annihilator. Then one last issue, and then we can talk about these more in detail if you like. One last issue, I wanted to talk a little bit about what you have to do if you're interested in filing a CO claim or if you're interested in the whole process. As I said before, you have to register within 30 days of your 18th birthday. When a draft comes and you get your number in the mail, you have 10 days. Go to the post office, and well, you have 10 days actually to report.
The date they mail.
Right.
Not when you receive it. You have to receive it in 10 days.
Right. And if you're interested in, if you sit and do nothing, then you're drafted. If you are interested in anything other than being drafted, you go to your post office and you fill out a form, and they have the exemptions there. Well, one thing I forgot to tell you, out of the seven attitudes that I described, the only ones that are legal at this point are the conscientious participant, obviously, is legal. A militarist, I suppose, is legal. I guess they find a lot of those guys. And my brother-in-law is a ranger, and he's pretty gung-ho. conscientious objector, 1AO and 1O are legal. The government has provided for those two positions. The non-cooperator is not legal. Like I say, you can face up to $10,000 fine and 5 years in prison if you don't register. and the selective conscientious objector is not legal. And that one in particular is a cause of concern to the mainline churches, which feel that it should be legal. The Lutherans and the Catholics, especially Presbyterians, feel that the government should respect the just war tradition and should allow young men to stay out if it's not a just war. There are many people, for example, who were willing to fight in World War II who weren't willing to fight in Vietnam because they saw one as more of a just war and one as more of an unjust war. Anyway, so you have the 10 days. You go to your post office and you fill out the form that says, a little box that says, I'm interested in conscientious objection. You mail it off with a registered mail, return receipt requested. It's so important to do that. Stuff gets lost easily. And when you go before your draft board, you're allowed to have witnesses to come with you and to testify to your sincerity. The people who have a better chance of getting the CO exemption are people who have been pacifists for a long time and can substantiate that. So that's why the draft counseling agencies encourage those young men who are interested in CO to start to write a statement. Why are you against war if you are against war? Spell it out. This is what I believe. This is where I got these beliefs. And then to get some letters of support, preferably from people who disagree with you, who can vouch for your sincerity. So my dad wrote me a letter, and he said, my son will not make it in the military. Please let him out. So, and I was grateful for that. You have to go before the draft board, and usually the draft board is composed of what they call your peers and neighbors. People who know you from your hometown, people who aren't necessarily professional counselors, the school teacher and the fireman and the guy who runs the hardware store and that sort of thing. And they just sit down for an informal talk with you. And it's interesting to note that this fella, he was real active in labor issues before the war, and he was involved in the single tax movement too, which was sort of a land reform program. And all the guys on the draft board knew who he was. They all knew him. They were friends with him. And they kept saying, look, we know you're a Catholic, but we'll still give you a break. Why don't you be a railway clerk in the army or something, And his beliefs were so strong that he didn't go along with that. But the disadvantage of the draft board is that because it's supposedly an informal meeting of peers and neighbors, sometimes the draft board can kind of skirt around the rules. They're not held as accountable as an official government agency would be. So there's some problems with the whole system in that. Well, I guess that's about all I could say as an introduction to those. Are there questions about any or all of them? What time do we have? We've got about 5 minutes. Anybody want to say anything else? Jackie?
Why do you make people aware of Lutheran peace
fellowships? Yeah, off in the lobby of the hotel, right? They're headquartered in Minneapolis, right? John Schramm's involved with them, the former director. Is there anything else you wanted to say about that?
Well, I just call your attention to the bishop's pastor letter of 85, in defense of creation. It goes back to your earlier point, but it talks about the just war, crusade, just war, and resistance, basically. And it started on the nuclear energy, nuclear bomb, nuclear
wars, right.
And it's taken. Is specifically clear that there is no just use of nuclear weapons. Therefore, it's I'm very fine to say that all wars are evil. And invite the churches to read the book and discuss.
Right.
Just a footnote, in Poland, we were missionaries in Poland the last couple of years. The Poles, two years ago, established the conscientious objection.
Oh.
For the Polish army.
Yeah, it's harder
around the oasis, but it's there, and they've established alternative service.
Can Catholics do that too?
Yes.
Okay.
It's more difficult because they don't have a history of this, but they allow it. And I was reading in Eastern Germany, about 40% of Lutherans are conscientious.
Oh, really?
But, yeah, which is kind of a significant number.
Yeah.
People are Lutherans. I don't know what percentage of it is. 70-80% of East Germany is Lutheran.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I didn't realize that.
Also read that there are about 300 conscientious objectors in the Republic of South Africa. Who, there are two positions, basically, is that they will not kill fellow citizens, so the blacks are not citizens. They will not kill fellow countrymen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, the purpose of the army in South Africa is to destroy black people. And therefore, it's not just the thou shalt not kill issues that they see. The reason for it being that.
Support apartheid.
But there are some 300 of these young white men who they do 5 years hard.
Right, yeah, as I understand, it's really difficult.
It's this thing, and that's the way sort of they go, but there are about 300 of them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting move.
Good. Are there other questions in the back?
What might you say to somebody who goes back to the Old Testament and talks about the Israelites, you know, defending themselves Saul and David raising their armies? People who look at defense in those terms, you know, physically, the Israelites arming themselves. What do you say to people who think in those terms?
Right. Well, we talked about that a little earlier, but with the militarist position, you know, people who look to the Book of Joshua and all that sort of thing. That's a hard issue. I mean, the Bible gives different messages on this. You know, the Bible is such a vast collection of different writings, you know, from different times. This fellow, someone asked him that, and he said, well, God might have ordered them to go to war, but he hasn't ordered us since, so I'm not going.
My mother was very much a biblical literate.
Really?
Even though she's 80 years old, that was her point.
Uh-huh. Well, then there's the turn the other cheek and all that. So it's kind of you know, if you take it all literally, then it's kind of mind-boggling. You know?
I think it has to do with the New Testament, Jesus.
Yeah.
He didn't have any vision.
It's important as Christians to look to Christ, you know, because we get confused easily about a lot of issues, and to look to him. As Luther said, was Christum private, what there is Christ. Steve?
Do you think that the recent apathy among a lot of traditional college students towards patriotism ties in with this in any way?
With
any of
some of the issues?
Yeah.
Well, what sort of stuff are you thinking of in particular?
Just non-patriotic actions.
Yeah.
Apathy, they can kill us.
Well, that's a hard issue. That a lot of the people who are supporting the National Service Bill are saying that same thing. You know, we've got to instill responsibility and patriotism again. I think they've lost it.
A lot of them haven't ever experienced it.
Yeah.
Well, the reality is that the yuppie war, or what you call a low-intensity conflict, we can hire a gun. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we can afford to be empathetic because we aren't personally called to be involved. We just pay our taxes on our $70,000 to $100,000 a year that we make. It's significant.
I'm not talking about traditional college students, I don't think that.
No, but they're not asked to go. We hire locals in Guatemala and El Salvador and Philippines, and so we hire locals. We subsidize the war for locals to kill each other.
It seems like they could not go and still have patriotism.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
Yeah, that's...
You could drive it from
But it's not coming out that way.
Right. Yeah, Sam Nunn of Georgia, the senator who's behind the National Service Bill, his argument is that, you know, kids don't really have to think about it, you know, so we got to start to get them to think about it and realize that they're part of the group. They're not just their own reality.
But the individualization of our life, in which I'm going to make it, the military is not conducive to that. So if the patriotism of our society and these young college students is basically focused on making it for me, making it for mine, and that's the patriot, that's the patriotism of this generation. Our leaders are making it. They're all making it big. Money is very important in our society. And our students are taking MBAs and going big in the money-making careers, by and large.
Mm-hmm. And the military
is that way. So that they are very patriotic, but they're not involved in the waving of the flag. That's exactly what our patriotism is.
It is. It's a warp sense.
Well, I think it is too, but I think that's what we're committed to as a people.
Any last comments? We got time for one more. Well, Rebecca?
I was thinking about some of the concept that comes up in me when I think about resist, like, if I've been alive in World War I and II, the concept of resisting is that, well, especially in World War I, the idea was that it was a just war and you were going to be helping these other people by fighting and defeating the enemy. But when we won the war, we kind of brought on the Second World War by our punishment to the Germans. And then even after we won the Second World War, we still continually repressed all sorts of peoples. And it kind of seems like whatever government you're under, there's going to be repression. And I don't think it's really takes the one government over the book.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, just war doesn't really exist. I don't think.
Yeah, America's had a hard time figuring out what its role is in the world. You know, after World War II, we kind of saw ourselves as the benevolent policeman, you know. And at times we've become kind of a bully, whether intentionally or unintentionally. We're a pretty big bully, we're pretty powerful, so when we hit, it hurts. Well, thanks for coming, all of you. There are copies of this in the bookstore.